speaking, sleep has probably a number of factors involved in its causation. Now, sleep, as we have recognized it, has a number of different types and divisions within itself. We have always thought of the individual as being either awake or asleep. While this may be true, generally speaking, we are sometime going to discover that the term sleep covers a wide variety of different processes, that there are levels and layers of sleep, that the house of sleep has many rooms, not merely this one departure from objectivity. In sleep, then, we notice a number of constitutional peculiarities, and the old stargazers came to some conclusions about these. We're not going to labor these conclusions, but they may be worth mentioning. Namely, that the sleep processes of individuals are influenced by the positions of planets in their nativities, and that persons with certain positions of planets have difficulty sleeping in various parts of the night, are more subject to being awakened, and have essentially different sleep rhythms. Now, for instance, we like to believe that everybody should have about 8 hours, that they should go to bed around 10 o'clock, they should get up around 7 or 6:30, and that this constitutes the good old-fashioned agricultural agrarian pattern based on the importance of milking the cow at the right time. Actually, these processes are among the imaginary rules which man has created. A number of persons, particularly of certain temperaments, find that 8 hours of sleep will not suffice. Others find that it is too much. The amount of sleep necessary is apparently regulated by a number of different faculties and circumstances, and that one of the elements is the soundness or depth of this sleep. Some people sleep lightly, others heavily. Sleep may also vary from night to night in the life of a particular individual, affected by temperature, noise, climate, food, all these different factors. It is observable that the young generally require more sleep than those of older years, whereas the aged frequently flourish on comparatively little sleep, but may require more rest. Thus we find a clear division gradually arising between rest and sleep. Rest is very largely a process of reducing the exhaustion of resources without necessarily sacrificing consciousness. Sleep represents a more or less complete exclusion of the consciousness factor. Some find sleep more easy in the early morning hours. Many artists and creative persons find that they do best work in the deep hours of the night. Many creative thinkers have been night workers and have found that the peculiar situation of night is especially suitable to them. Now, how can this be true if, for example, we know that the night energies have a tendency to be numb or to lower the vibratory rate? I think the answer lies in this, that these creative geniuses have seldom been trapeze artists. What they have been, for the most part, is sedentary persons. They are persons who have done most of their creativity either in terms of mathematics, in literature, art, music, and creativity of thinking, and that they are therefore inclined to achieve a kind of physical relaxation in which they rest the body but are able to maintain the stimulation of the mind. Also, as the person's internal life strengthens, he becomes less and less dependent upon the patterns of external living. The person, therefore, who psychologically is in constant or nearly constant communion with his inner life, requires a different kind of rest and a different kind of energy from the person whose objectives are almost totally physical. Therefore, at night, the tendency of the world, of material things in that area, is to slow down. And in this slowing down of interruption, discord, and the pressure of excitement and excitation of nerve energy, the scholar, the thinker, the mystic, the artist, the poet, the musician, will find a quiet composure in which his own creativity is most likely to be available to him. In other words, he is, by resting, achieving a kind of vision or a kind of sleep experience without actually being unconscious. He has made a more or less conscious bridge between himself as an objective person and his own subjective psychic resources. And in these resources are the areas of creativity which are therefore able to come through to him. If he was under tremendous nerve stress, fatigue would probably put him to sleep. But if he is relaxed under these pressures, he is therefore able to be receptive to the psychic pressures which most of us record only in dream phenomena. The next thing that we take on is this problem of what I call the twilight hour. And this has more or less the factor of tying all these ends together to create the major picture that we are trying to bring to attention. Man, primarily, is a mental being. He is a physical being because he is in a physical body, and this body has certain needs which the individual must supply, and which he is adequately able to supply because he does possess a mental nature. And by this mental nature, he has the ingenuity and the creativity to meet the various needs of the body. Consciously, however, the average human being does not accept this point of view. He accepts the point of view that his reality is physical, not mental. That the mind, therefore, exists primarily to support the body. Whereas, more correctly, the body is merely a supporting instrument by means of which certain abilities are conferred upon the mind. Thus, man, by wrongly focusing his energy or his point of awareness, has mistakenly assumed that his physical nature is himself. And under this false assumption, he has bound his mental equipment not to providing the necessities of his physical existence in the term of the simple needs, by means of which the rest of his energies might be available for other purposes, but he has cast all of his energies into this physical problem, and therefore as little if any opportunity or energy for the advancement of his own true estate, which is that of a thinking creature. Thinking is largely defensive or evasive at the moment. It is merely the individual thinking himself in and out of difficulty. This is not the purpose of the mind. The purpose of the mind is to have a positive existence of its own. In the peculiarly small hours between darkness and daylight, we have this period of twilight. This period of twilight corresponds also with a kind of equilibrium between earth and solar energy. The first rays, so to say, of the solar life is returning. It exists as an auroral glow. It is reflected in the sky from some other part of the heaven where day already has arrived. It is, however, merely a glow of anticipatory light. And in the process of the mingling of this first feebleness of the solar energy with the subtle energies of the earth, there comes a period or a brief time when these two energies are brought into equilibrium, before one conquers the other. As night falls, the earth conquers the solar energy. As dawn comes, the solar energy conquers the earth. The sun god Horus slays the python, the god of night. But there is this period in which there is almost a complete equilibrium. In this complete equilibrium, we have a mysterious foreshadowing or a mysterious symbolic statement of equilibrium in the psychic life of man. We have a point in which, for the moment, there is no conflict, where things are in some such complete balance that both of the areas of activity are in harmony, each with the other. In this peculiar suspension, man has the greatest availability of his total life. He has those moments which are the nearest to being the accurate moments, the moments in which neither his addiction to the external nor his submergence in the internal dominates. Each has united with the other. The Egyptians symbolized the peculiar twilight, therefore, of the dawn as a door between the worlds, as an entranceway or gate in which lives could move both ways. In these hours, according to the Hermetic doctrines, Hermes Trismegistus, the Psychopompus, or herder of souls, herd souls back and forth between the worlds of the dead and the worlds of life, or between the worlds of sleeping and the worlds of waking. In these moments, two conditions of energy come so closely together that they form a mysterious alchemical compound. Perhaps it is the ancient symbol of the marriage of the sun and moon as the symbol of the marriage of spirit and matter. But here in this equilibrium, there is a moment of validity that never occurs at any other part of the 24-hour day, of the 24 hours of the day. The old peoples believed that this point of equilibrium lasted only for a few minutes. Some held that the complete equilibrium, perhaps only about 3 minutes. Then one or the other gains its ascendancy. And in the dawn, it is the sun that gains ascendancy. Why is this also not true in the evening hours? Why isn't this twilight between light and darkness equally important? The answer is that the nerve stress of the day has produced a psychic exhaustion. And in this psychic exhaustion, the equilibrium is not achieved. The equilibrium seems to be based partly upon the body having first attained rest. Consequently, it is in the morning hours and not in the evening hours that this peculiar transitional period exists. It is usually somewhere between 4 and 5 a.m., differing again with the seasons and the ancient system of planetary hours, and being conditioned to some degree by the motions and positions of the heavens each day at that hour. But the ancients held the basic pattern to be valid. In this peculiar suspension, then, it seems as though the entire person is open at one time. Now, actually, man does not have the conscious experience of this openness. He probably awakes in the morning refreshed if his rest has been reasonably good. He does awaken energized with more abundant self-control, with greater optimism for the day, with stimulation to make plans come true, he arises, if he's in good health, with the proverbial bounce, and proceeds immediately to waste half of it with his setting up exercises. By the time he gets through those, he's ready to go back to bed again. But he feels good about it, and he is optimistic, and that is a very important factor. You will never find an animal do setting up exercises. You have to be a little stupid to do it, but a lot of people believe it helps. The belief will help them if the exercises do not. Actually, man's problem of exercise is not also at all well handled. Socrates pointed out once that exercise was meaningless unless the individual who was exercising was accomplishing something. Socrates absolutely refused to take a walk unless he was going somewhere. But he strongly recommended that everybody be going somewhere. But the exercise must be valid. It must not be for its own sake, or you will produce only an athlete with a profoundly low IQ. The problem of the morning awaking following this rest period also gives us some key to these twilight experiences in the morning hours. If it is true, and there seems much to sustain, that there is a peculiar psychochemical balance, and that two states of consciousness have the greatest possibility of mingling without conflict at that time, then it is obvious that the internal life of man is most available to him in these hours. Also, that the external factors or faculties have the greatest receptivity to knowledge. Also, in a sense, if man has any power which will enable him to explore himself, he will have the greatest facility in doing this in these particular periods of time. Thus, the communion of kindred spirits is established as the balance is reached. From this situation, several things may naturally come into expression. Man, having at that moment the greatest availability of his own totality, is perhaps in those moments the wisest that he can be in this world. This means that if there be some particular reason for a peculiar attitude, he can hold it. The Egyptians also had the thought that it is not important whether man remembers these things or not, that actually they occur, whether we know it or not, and that by this occurrence a certain internal psychic balance is maintained, that every time we reach this mysterious twilight hour, we have this interchange, whether we know it or not. And that this interchange is very important in maintaining the psychic health of the person. And if he does not know anything about it, this is perfectly all right, but he does arise more clear-minded and with greater available intuitive power as a result of this experience. It follows, then, that if in these hours there is some peculiar need that has arisen, if in this particular time of the meeting of two natures brought together in at least reasonable rapport, if there is some particular exchange of basic idea or energy necessary, then we are very likely to have the significant dream experience. This is the time in which the psychic nature can most directly communicate with the objective functions and faculties of the body and mind. It is at this time that the will of heaven can be most quickly known on earth. It is at this time that the person behind the body or in the body issues its daily regulatory recommendations to the body. It is at this moment that the divine establishes its relationship to the person every single 24-hour period. This situation is something perhaps that needs to be remembered, for it is a kind of daily psychic quickening, a process of reestablishing a covenant between the inner man and the outer personality. This covenant is necessary to life. And if a situation in the conduct of an individual or in his habits becomes so impossible that this covenant cannot be established, then he is in trouble. So you may say, what of a person on a swing shift who never has these hours available to himself, who is in some line of work in which he is dedicated to that delightful path known as the graveyard hours, in which he has to be awake then? As the research into the problem seems to point out that under those conditions the exchange still takes place, but it is less obvious to the person. And when we realize that the exchange is exceedingly rapid, and that the person might very well not be consciously aware of very much of it, the condition can occur, just as it has occurred in the case of persons who are known to have been able to sleep without any apparent interference with conscious procedure. Individual, I've told you the story of the man who was shot in the brain during World War I, who did not sleep again for 18 years, worked three shifts a day, 24 hours a day, without being tired, and was never aware of sleeping. But actually, he was sleeping most of the time, but doing so in a series of very rapid sleep experiences lasting only fractions of a second. He was having constantly alternating consciousness and unconsciousness, but it was so rapid that he was not aware of it. So that nature takes care of these things unless we prevent her from doing so. But that this psychic exchange does normally take place, there is much to indicate, and that may or may not be always known to the person. But inside of man, this exchange is also vibratorily necessary to his survival. If he is then under pressure of some nature, the pressure of need, the pressure of urgency, it is most likely that in these hours, these pressures will exercise their maximum effect, and the communication may be in the form of a solutional occurrence, a prophetic dream, a vision, or a trance-like incident, in which the individual will receive some kind of a direct impartment of vitality or energy from his own causal nature. Let us assume for a moment that an individual is living a rather badly integrated life, that this bad integration is gradually destroying the physical relationship between this person's body and his psychonervous system. He is worrying too much. He is too frightened over some situation that has arisen. He has lacked courage. He is drifting. He is postponing necessary decisions. He is confused. He is gradually going down for the third time in a sea of his own troubles. This situation, going on and on and on over a period of time, will ultimately result in what might be termed psychic exhaustion. He will come in the end to what we know as a nervous breakdown. Or he will continue policies and practices until he destroys perhaps his business, or his home, or his social standing. Inside of himself, his own psychic life tells him that something is wrong. He is not quite able to bring these patterns together. He still remains without a sense of the answer that is necessary to meet this emergency. So finally, in the course of this process of gradual suicide, which he has fallen into, he comes to one of these early morning hour periods in which his own psychic life that knows better, his own over-self, as Emerson may have called it, in whose broader explanation and interpretation of things rests the true facts which this man has been unable to rescue from the things that have happened to him. Actually, he has always been in possession of all that he needed to solve his problem, but he doesn't know it. He hasn't read the symptoms correctly. He hasn't sensed the right significance of the symbols of happenings that have occurred. He hasn't taken advantage of certain occurrences which would have shown him what he was doing and why it was wrong. He has become confused, he has lost orientation, and he simply cannot even judge the merits or demerits of his own ideas. About this time, one of these vision experiences or dream experiences may strike him. It may come in a warning. It may warn him in some way of the impending difficulty. It may be a diagnosis. It may take originally the form of simply revealing to him the direction of his own trouble. He may awaken with an allegorical concept rather strongly set in his mind. He's been a good churchman down through the years. It may possibly be that in this experience he will find himself reminded of the two men, one who built his house on a rock and the other his house on sand. Perhaps he will find himself standing on sand, which gives away underneath him, or in the midst of some morass or swamp that threatens to swallow him up. Perhaps he will find himself lost in a jungle or forest or wilderness surrounded by savage animals that threaten him. Any one of innumerable symbols may come through to him as a representation that he is heading into trouble, that his own life is like this morass and that he's bogged down, or that he is a small child wandering around in a wilderness or a desert where he doesn't know where he's going, or that some strange and incredible disaster hangs over his head like the sword of Damocles. Many persons have actually dreamt of the sword of Damocles and have seen the sword hanging over their heads. This is due, of course, to the fact that we draw upon stories and legends that we know in the effort to clothe these basic impulses, which are in themselves usually formless. In any event, these things together could constitute a warning. They may send this man in some direction for psychological help, especially if the dream is repeated. Or it may be that this dream is enough to awaken the dreamer, cause him to realize that he is in trouble, and perhaps try to help him to direct his courses more wisely. To another type of person, the dream impingement or the vision symbolism may come as a direct therapy in itself. It may come in the form of the psychic overself showing the person the parts of his own story which he has never seen correctly. He may find, therefore, truly an advising situation. It may be that for a long time, his worries have been vested in a certain stock that he owns, or in a certain kind of investment for which he is not fitted. Or he may learn by subconscious knowledge that he is in a profession, art, or trade which is not proper for him. One of these dream experiences may blast into this. The inside, balancing, equilibrating consciousness simply says to him in one way or another, usually symbolic, "Look, Joe, you have been a barber for 20 years, but you were never meant to be one. You're never going to be happy or healthy because this isn't the thing you want to do. What you have always really wanted to do was to be a carpenter. So now go out and be a carpenter if you want to get well." Now, the dream may not be quite that clear or quite that obvious, but it will present in symbolic form the direction which the person should go or should travel. It would remind him, perhaps, that he has been on the wrong road and may actually use the road as a symbol. There are cases where persons in the wrong occupation have actually had the dream, that either they were on a wrong road or that they had come down a street on their way home and had gotten into the wrong house. Now, the wrong house, of course, is a very interesting symbol because it means largely a wrong way of life. It means a wrong habitation of character. One man had a dream that he went into a house which he thought was his own, and it proved to be somebody else's house, and when he got in there, he saw himself dead in the front room. Well, this is a cheerful little thought, but what does it mean? It merely tells this man that he is in the wrong house, and if he stays there, he's going to find himself dead there. He is going to crack up. Now, whether he is physically dead or whether it symbolizes the fact that as long as he is in this wrong house, he will be as dead, as though dead. Nothing will operate properly. Nothing will work well for him. His present situation is wrong. He's in the wrong house, and in that house, he can only be dead. Nothing will ever truly come to life. Perhaps this man then rushes out of the house in his dream experience and rushes down the street. And where does he go? Well, he is terrified. He is half sick. He doesn't know what that is going to happen. And in this dream, he rushes down the street looking in various directions to find where he shall go. And he finally comes to a church. So he rushes into the church and falls down on his knees to pray. Now, this is also telling him something else. It isn't necessarily telling him to go to church. This is really too obvious for a psychic experience. They are not that literal. What it is telling him is that he needs consolation of understanding, of inner character, that he is deficient in faith, that in some mysterious way he has not sought inner guidance, and the church becomes to almost everyone a symbol of divine or inner guidance. And the recommendation is, of course, that he listens more to the inside and less to the outside. That he doesn't depend upon his own objective mind, but depends upon this intuitive power, which men have always symbolized as a divine principle in themselves. Now, another interesting thing happens in a great many of these kinds of experiences. There is a strategic and carefully calculated point at which the person awakens. The time of awakening in the dream is sometimes of the greatest significance, inasmuch as it generally tells one of two things. Waking either indicates acceptance, and the moment there is acceptance, there can no longer be any problem. The reduction of tension by acceptance brings the psychological intensity of the vision to its natural termination. Or else, there may be so much resistance to the truth on the part of the individual that at a certain point he rejects the experience completely and escapes by waking up. There is therefore always this problem to consider, that as the various phases of analysis proceed, perhaps the same dream will recur, but the individual will awaken at a different part of the dream. This is an indication of certain acceptances or massive rejection on the part of the individual. This, of course, also points out something that we cannot really deny and have really no intentions of denying, and that is that these kind of visions seem to also, in many instances, imply the element of foreknowledge. General foreknowledge is not difficult. An individual can dream, for example, that he falls from a cliff and breaks a leg. Now, he may be quite upset by this dream, and he may be very, very careful from that time to stay away from cliffs. He assumes that the dream is a literal thing, whereas more likely, the dream represents a symbolic accident. In other words, if he continues in a certain course of procedure, something will happen. For instance, how did he happen to fall off the cliff? The dream may vary on this point. Perhaps he is pushed off. Perhaps he is running away from something and falls over the edge. Perhaps he is tired of life and decides to cast himself off of the cliff. And having cast himself off, suddenly wishes he hadn't halfway down. This type of dream, therefore, of the falling or dropping from a cliff, may have a number of interpretations, some of them more or less prophetic. Perhaps the dream is telling the individual that he can no longer run away from the incident. That if he tries to escape again, he will have some form of an accident. That he cannot escape, that his present effort to run away from himself or from other things can lead him only to falling off a cliff. If 6 months later this person has not paid any attention to the symbolism, has made no change in his ways, then a policy which he is practicing and which is itself wrong may close in upon him. One man dreamed that he was trying to run away from a certain situation that seemed very difficult. And as he ran out into a road and was struck by a car. He had the sense of being struck, but as is usual in dreams, he did not have the actual experience of dying. He woke up after he was struck. The shock, the psychic shock of the accident, awakened him. 6 months later, his home fell apart. And he found himself with a divorce case on his hands. He had been trying to run away from certain characteristics. In so doing, he had undermined the stability of his home. And finally, the breaking of the home was represented by the accident. He ran out in front of the car which struck him. In attempting to run away from the, in this case, his problem was evasion of maturity. The individual refused psychologically to accept the responsibility of being a husband and a parent. He was in a panic. The attempt to run away was indicated by it, and the running away ending in a worse accident was then later indicated as the breaking up of his home. He knew it was coming subconsciously. His own inner life knew that if he continued this procedure, it would end in the destruction of his home. Consciously, he would not acknowledge this. And when the thing finally happened and the home broke, he was completely astonished. But actually, his subconscious knew all the time that his way of procedure could produce no other consequence. Therefore, nature takes the very simple but prophetic position that a fault never corrected or a wrong pattern never mended is always going to end in the loss of something we want. It is always going to end in the loss of something that is meaningful to us. What we abuse, we lose. And the individual running away was in this case the attempt to evade responsibility. So these kinds of dreams can take generally prophetic form, because as soon as the incident actually occurs, then we are able to say, well, this is obviously what the dream meant. But up to that time, we were rather careful for fear that it may be a literal accident that is implied. In some cases, a physical accident may be indicated, and it may actually occur. But in the majority of instances, it is a symbolic one. Now, where it is a complete accident, following the direct pattern of the vision, where something is pre-visioned, as in the case of a man who had a vision, a very definite one, that the train on which he rode to the city every day was going to be wrecked. He saw the incident clearly. He even visually, inwardly knew the day on which this wreck would occur. He actually saw himself, apparently, in this wreck. When the day came, he simply refused to get on the train. He warned all his friends that he could, but most of them paid no attention to it, thinking it was merely some kind of an hysteria. The train was wrecked, but he was not on it. He had had a clear, insight or foresight into an actual occurrence that was to take place. Now, in the terms of a vision or a mystical experience of that kind, how are we going to explain this? The first thing we know is that the person consciously did not have this record. The train had made this run for probably 20 years without a previous accident. It was not something that would be normally likely to be in his subconscious. Actually, therefore, there is only one answer, namely that the subconscious or the superconscious or whatever lies behind the conscious has the power of a certain kind of foreknowledge. That this foreknowledge may be available to certain persons at certain times. Why it is not available to other persons is a question that perhaps goes back to the Eastern ideas of karmic compensation. In any event, some persons apparently either have so altered their destinies by their own conduct that they are entitled to escape from these emergencies, or in some way or other, they were not intended to be involved and had to be protected. There is a belief in the Orient, and perhaps this is as good an answer until we find a better one, and it's going to take quite a little finding before we find it, is very definitely that the entity, there is a belief in the East, that the entity coming into birth comes in with a certain karmic debt. Now, the karmic responsibility of a person is usually very much larger than could possibly be compensated for in a single lifetime. Therefore, at a certain period, in the process of embodiment, the entity as a psychic being, more or less, is shown the record, shown the debt it has to pay and how that debt will be paid, and the various circumstances leading up to it. So that as far as the psychic entity or the incarnating entity is concerned, there can never be an actual moment in which the psychic being does not understand what is happening to it. In other words, there can never be on the higher part of man's nature any doubt concerning the honesty of the situations in which he is involved. But the objective consciousness is not aware of this. Therefore, it is possible that the archetypal image of the total course of a life and the depths and lessons peculiar to that embodiment in the terms of its karma may be available to the psychic entity, and that this availability becomes the basis of an immediate prophetic power. As this psychic entity, prophetic power factor, has to depend upon the moving of physical circumstances to meet the needs of the karmic pattern, there has to be an interrelationship between the need of the individual and the foreknowledge of the social motion itself. In other words, there has to be an archetypal motion behind every event that occurs. Every event that we see has to be a seed breaking through ground into visibility. The invisible part of that event lying in its karmic relationship to life and in the causes which produce it. If there is an archetype or an Akashic record, not only of things that have happened, but of the natural unfoldment of life collective according to its own destiny, then the relationship of man to the common destiny may be available to the consciousness of the individual. In any event, incidents of this kind have occurred. No simple explanation that will be of immediate acceptance by all scientific and otherwise, no such explanation is likely to be found. The only answer has to be that there are dimensions of archetypal records in nature that are beyond our estimation, and that on these archetypal records there is a certain aura or area in which the future is almost fatalistically conditioned by present circumstances or conditions, and that this relative future can be grasped or known psychically. Thus, the person's place in this relative future can be anticipated. Where the anticipation does not occur, where the individual goes quietly to his destiny without ever knowing that it is his destiny, obviously, under those conditions, the pattern works in its complete operation. But supposing for a moment, man being an individual, has along the course of his lifetime made certain basic changes in his own temperament. These changes may alter or condition his destiny. For with man as a self-conscious being, destiny cannot be fatalistic. Thus, if for some reason his own relationships to events change, then it's possible that the psychic life within him is given the problem or given the responsibility to adjust his relationship to events to meet the psychological changes in his own nature. Thus, one may be warned and ten are not. 10 persons may pass through the same experience and one survive. The same thought was, of course, largely used in the development of the story of the Bridge of San Luis Rey, in which persons of many types gathered on the bridge when it collapsed. Each one, however, who was there, though apparently in no way related to any common moment or common point, each was where he had to be in order that the various threads of life should all work out. I believe that the so-called vision, which deals with events to come, merely represents the fact that the psychic nature is aware of this and aware of what these events must be. But that if this awareness was communicated generally to the objective life, the entire process of destiny would be frustrated. The individual, without merit or without reason, being in a position to foreknow his own destiny and avert it, would no longer be operating with nature. Because the only way a person can justly avoid a destiny is to outgrow it. And if he doesn't outgrow it, then he has no right to change it. The psychic life in him, being primarily concerned with the good of the individual and his ultimate fulfillment of the laws of his own being, will not be nearly so concerned with accidents and incidents as the perfection of character, regardless of cost in terms of life and death as we know these terms. Thus, there are many situations that can be considered, but apparently this peculiar timing of ours becomes associated with the most generally valid period by means of which this interchange of worlds takes place. And that, therefore, this becomes a peculiar period, the twilight dawn, which is the great period of the instruction of man. And whereas in the rest of the day, he is instructed by the world around him, in this period, he is peculiarly instructed by the world within him and behind him. And as a result of this instruction, there is a constant flowing of intuitive truth into his consciousness. This intuitive truth being, of course, the basis of certain inspirational growth from within himself. Realizing this, we recognize that perhaps the ancient was right when he declared that at this time the worlds came together, that a door opened, and mysteries came forth, and man in turn approached the gate of mystery. By the common interchange of his internal and external parts, gained a continual participation in that which he needed to know in order to continue. For man must be moved not only by the circumstances around him, but by the life within him. And as the life within him has very little authority during his waking hour, it is in this other period that this inner life, as its moment of authority, and in this moment provides the tremendous energy release that protects the individual not only through the rest of the 24 hours, but perhaps for many days. This understanding of this peculiar psychological process may have in due time its place also in our researches along psychological lines. Well, I think our time is pretty well up, so that's about all we can do with it now. Now, this will be the last of our Wednesday evening meetings until after the first of the year. After the first of the year, why, I shall have to go to San Antonio, Texas, for a short series of lectures, and we will begin our activities here again about the middle of January. At that time, we will also have a new series of Wednesday evening meetings. The first series will be devoted to a reconsideration of the subjects given on Sunday mornings, which will be our annual world predictions. There will be five in this series. The second series in the spring program will begin sometime probably around March. It will be devoted to a study in five evenings of our book, Man, the Grand Symbol of the Mysteries, bringing to focus upon this new material that we have stored away concerning the mysteries of the human body and its functions and its relation to occult anatomy and physiology. Those will be the two classes of the winter season. You will all receive your programs in due time. And I thank you very much for being with us this evening.